So I'd like to know just your general thoughts on what, like, domestic violence does to a marriage, and if there is domestic violence within a marriage, or, like, one episode of abuse or something.
Yeah, that's another thing. Let's go to the next one.
I want to show you the world through my eyes, show you the colors in my mind, let laughter spring up from the ground that I've cried.
Welcome back to the Anatomy of Marriage miniseries. I'm your host, Melanie Studley, and before we get started, I just wanted to let you know that if you like the Anatomy of Marriage miniseries, there is more to explore when you subscribe to the Anatomy of Marriage podcast. So, if you want to continue on this journey with us, head over to iTunes and subscribe now. But today, we're talking all about domestic violence. And none of the stories in this episode are going to be graphic or anything like that, but rather, they are a venture into a world that far too many of us ignore.
So with couples, this is what I would say.
This is Leslie Vernick, author of several books, including The Emotionally Destructive Marriage and The Emotionally Destructive Relationship. You'll remember her from episode one.
Every marriage has its problems. Every single marriage can even have abuse in it for a moment. Okay. And I tell a story about me when I was a young mom. My little guy, Ryan, was in the dressing room with me. Of course, I was trying on clothes, and he did not want to be there with me at 2 years old. This was boring to death to him, and he had had enough, and he decided to throw a fit on the floor of the dressing room, screaming at the top of his lungs, "I don't want to be here," and, you know, embarrassing the daylights out of me. So in a moment of anger, I reached down, and I grabbed his little arm on the floor as he was flailing, and I yanked him to his feet, and I said, "Stop it right now!" And he goes, "Mom, you broke my arm," loud as could be, and his little elbow was dangling from his arm. Oh. And I had yanked his arm out of his socket. And so I felt horrible. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm becoming like my mother. And I rushed into the emergency room. I told the doctor what I did. I didn't make up a story. Like, I didn't say he fell. I said I yanked his arm. I broke his arm. He said, "Well, it's not broken. You just dislocated his elbow and popped it back in." Went home, told my husband. And I said, "You know what? I've got to get help because I don't want to be like my mom." You know, again, you follow in some old habits, reactionary from your childhood. And so that's what I would call an abusive incident. That was a wake-up call for me, for my husband, for my son. You know, he's only 2 years old. I didn't blame him. I didn't make excuses. I didn't lie about it. So all of us are capable of doing some very destructive things.
I asked Leslie why she felt the desire to write The Emotionally Destructive Marriage and to do the work that she does.
Well, you know, I grew up in an abusive home. My mom was the abuser. She left my father when I was only 8 years old, and that was 55 years ago. And I didn't know anybody else who was raised by a single mom at that time. And it was very painful for me to go through that divorce and understand. I didn't even understand why she chose to leave my dad. I don't think we were ever told exactly why. But as a result of that, she became very just bitter, full of anger, and drank a lot. She became mentally unstable and often took out her angst on me as the oldest, probably being the one who had the most pushback and biggest mouth and tried to challenge different things. She didn't care for that. So she took a lot of her angst out on me. And when I was 14 years old, my father, I had a younger brother and sister. When I was 14 years old, my father had been petitioning the courts for years to get us to get custody of us. And at that point, he won. That was, again, another God thing. It was so rare for fathers to get custody of their children in those days. So the fact that we had to move there, he had become a Christian, he had remarried, and so we were like the first Brady Bunch, really. She had three kids, he had three kids, and we had to put this thing together. And so we did, but what was really hard for me is once I became a Christian and I went to college and I got my master's degree in counseling, and I still couldn't have a relationship with my mother. I couldn't figure her out. I couldn't figure out how to deal with her temper. She didn't come to my wedding. She never saw my first child being born. She was still contentious and argumentative. And then my buttons would get pushed and I'd retaliate and say some verbal zingers of my own. And it was just very painful as a Christian person and as a professional. Like, I didn't know how to deal with my mother. And I thought, heck, I've been through, you know, lots of discipleship, lots of counseling training, and I can't do it. And I'm sure there's a lot of other people like me who don't know how to do this, don't understand this person, don't understand why they won't get help, don't understand why they won't change. And you get stuck in your own reactions to this person, and you get stuck in your own hurt that they won't do the work, and you get hurt in your own bitterness. And so I had to figure all that out personally, and I think that really equipped me to help people figure that out.
I have a big question here.
Here's Seth and I talking to our producer, Matt.
This sounds delicate, really, of an issue to even get into at all, because can somebody be abusive and move past it? Can it be an isolated incident? You hear so often that if somebody is this way, they're going to be that way and you just need to get out, mm-hmm. kind of thing. But is it really possible for somebody to be abusive one time? Because you risk giving somebody advice. Like, that's a scary thing to give advice to. Oh, somebody hit you. Well, you need to work on X, Y, and Z. And meanwhile, they're in danger.
That's what I don't understand. I mean, you are a therapist, so.
I mean, is the safe bet one violent incident, you are separated from that person forever, is the only safe way?
You know, I'm not going to say either or on that, because mm-hmm. just like Les and Leslie, it could be a very dangerous situation. But if we looked at it from a different context, say that like someone was struggling with drinking, and they you know, got a DUI one night and crashed their car, right? Mm-hmm. And that would be maybe similar to an incident where in a relationship things got into crisis mode and someone struck another person. Now, if that same person in the DUI incident quit drinking, went to treatment, and really got help and was okay for a very long time after that, then we would consider that guy or girl to be okay. They messed up, they, you know, paid their dues, they got help, they were contrite, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. And I think in an instance where domestic violence may happen, if that person was totally sorry, totally contrite, went to anger management classes, got appropriate counseling, and then had a solid track record after that, then I say, yeah, domestic violence could be a one-off incident. I mean, it was for us, right?
That's scary, though, of course, to even say.
It's very scary. Yeah. So I'm not going to say either or, you mm-hmm. know, because maybe, you know, again, you know, maybe that guy hit his wife, and then, oh, I'm sorry. This is usually how it happens in domestically violent situations.
Yeah, you always hear the guy, oh, he's so sorry,
I'm so sorry. I'll change the wife, you know, or the one that was perpetrated against. Gives them the benefit of the doubt, where they were under stress, they had all this stuff going on, and then it happens again, right? And then
cycle, it almost always does.
That cycle of control and manipulation usually always happens. So I'm not going to give, you know, as a clinical answer, I'm not going to give either or. However, it is possible for someone to come out on the other side.
Yeah. I mean, on the other side of that, otherwise it's a hard thing to say about somebody that once an abuser, always an abuser. That's a pretty tough sentence for somebody like Francis Melanie to deal, you know.
I wouldn't want to give that label to anyone. No.
It's a pretty harsh accusation, but I think it fits.
This is Susie, who you'll also remember from episode 1.
The word abuse comes to mind. Blocking a person from leaving, taking their keys, intimidating them is physical assault. Mm. It is assault. So I think a lot of women don't think it is.
Yeah.
If you punch the wall in the same room where I am, how do I know I'm not next? That's intimidation. That's physical abuse.
So just you know, sitting here thinking about these stories, thinking about, like...
Here's me and Seth in the car again.
A lot of the physical abuse that happened after and during that is, I don't like to think about it, you know? You just, like, yelling at me, you know, when I was, like, sleeping, or you waking me up yelling. The big one I remember was I had come home one day, and again, we were arguing all day, and you were outside raking leaves, I think. And I came outside to talk to you when I'd gotten home from work. I remember I had brought my work computer home, and you went, like, searching through history, but the work computer was also, other people had used it, and
there was like other stuff on there and you were asking me all these questions. I was like, no, that's not mine. I didn't do that. And you weren't believing me and you were just furious. And I said, no, it's not mine. And you were yelling. And then you tried to kick me in the groin and like I blocked it. And then you tried to kick me again and I blocked it. And I was like, you know, focused on your feet. And you came around and like just punched me square in the face. I think as hard as you could. I don't know. It was enough to give me a black eye and like have busted blood vessels and everything. And I remember I was, sure, it hurt, but that's not what I was focused on. And I remember, like, I was crying, you know. I cried because I was like, what is going on? What is this, you know? And I think... I think that changed a lot in our marriage.
So what I feel like I experienced was that the fight or flight thing, and it just shuts off all of your sort of higher cognitive functioning, like your ability mm-hmm. to right. think, should I punch my husband in the face? No.
It wasn't something you cognitively thought.
No, I literally felt like I couldn't. My brain was not all there. I didn't have all of it to use. And that is not to excuse my behavior, because I think had I learned those cognitive sort of, had I learned the skills to deal with someone
mm-hmm.
in who I didn't agree with yeah. better, I could have dealt with that better.
But on the other hand, it sounds like given that it wasn't a cognitive decision and you weren't able to stop it, it kind of makes it sound like given the right circumstances, yeah. it could happen again.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, again, well, I think
that's what we as therapists define as crisis. No, stress plus opportunity equals crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I'm super stressed out. He's there. I have the opportunity to punch him. I do it.
Yeah.
I'm you know, really depressed, feeling low as I've ever felt. There's a gun.
Yeah.
So stress mm-hmm. plus opportunity equals crisis. Yeah. And you were clearly acting from a crisis mode.
Yeah.
We had gotten in another argument, and I was really scared for my life. I thought, because it had gotten so bad, like the physical stuff, that I thought that you could really, you could have done some real damage if you wanted to. So I remember that I hid like all of my hunting stuff. So you couldn't, you know, hurt me or hurt yourself. And I remember I taking it all, and I was like, am I really doing this, you know? But at that point, nothing mattered except staying safe and trying to figure out what to do. So I'd taken all the hunting stuff and put it away, and I remember I went into our extra room and locked the doors and actually put the couch in front of the door so you couldn't get in, so you couldn't get to me, because I thought that you were going to attack me when we were sleeping.
Why didn't you get help? Because you never did.
I didn't feel that threatened. What?
You felt enough to hide the guns and ammunition, though.
Well,
what do you mean?
Who was I going to call? The cops on you?
Anyone.
I wasn't going to call the cops
call
on you.
Call my brother. I'd have straightened out in 1 second anyone I knew came down my driveway. I mean, I wouldn't have stopped like that.
You know, I don't know why. Well, I guess that this could be a whole nother episode, but it's like I thought I could do it myself. It's like I don't need to call anybody. I hid the guns. I mean, I can fight
but looking
her.
Back on it now, though.
I guess the bigger question is, you felt so strongly that I was unsafe.
Yes.
That you hid the ammunition and the firearms while we had two infants in our home sleeping in their
I
beds.
I didn't think that you were going to hurt the kids. I didn't think that you were really going to hurt yourself.
I mean, all I'm hearing here is that you were thinking quite irrationally your own self. It was, it's not, you know.
Maybe,
what I mean?
Maybe all like, I could do at that moment is like do exactly. I was thinking of worst case scenario. Like, okay, hide the guns. She's going to shoot herself or shoot me. I have the guns. I'm not going to shoot anybody. She can take a walk or whatever, and I'm locking myself in the room for tonight.
You just felt like we were isolated from the world, and then it was just deal with this one tiny weird craziness, and nothing else matters.
I think it's not the height of rational behavior on your part, at least.
Yeah. I think what all this says to me is that there needs to be a breaking of the stigma of even if you feel afraid in your marriage, we really need to be able to share that.
Yeah, that's
without
true.
Oh, what were you going to say?
I said, which way would you rather be wrong? Like, what if I called you three times over the next 2 years and said, I'm really scared about XYZ, that this might happen in our house, or that I might hurt my wife, or she might hurt me. What's the worst that could happen? I mean, best case scenario is you save a life.
Yeah.
Worst case scenario is you're embarrassed.
You were wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Obviously, the former.
It's just crazy to me to think of the fact that we, as a culture, are so afraid to admit that we are afraid of something. You know, like I will tell you, and I will tell my children, I don't want to go in the backyard at night. It's scary. But you won't tell someone you know and trust, my wife might hurt herself tonight.
Maybe there was some point that I didn't think they would actually go that far, which was naive of me.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's interesting. And it just makes me really think, like, there has to be this has to be made unembarrassing, or I mean, of course it won't be, because you'll feel weird saying I'm afraid of my husband or I'm afraid of my wife. But at the same time, like, what is there to lose? I think that you make a really great point in saying, oh, I might be embarrassed for 20 minutes. Who cares if you save a terrible situation from happening, or terrible words from being said, or, you know.
Well, let's look at it the other way. You say that almost simply, like, oh, I might be embarrassed for 20 minutes, but you'd have to think about, based on people's behavior, let's look at how huge embarrassment must actually be that it competes with safety.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how profound our self-image and projected image are to other people. If that is threatened, we're willing to risk safety.
You know, it's funny, because I've had people since I said he's out come to me and say, thank goodness, because I really was appalled at how he treated you.
Here's Susie again.
And I wonder why they didn't say it sooner. And I had other friends tell me he talks to you rudely, he treats you badly, you know, but they didn't tell me at the time. And I think there's this thing where it's like, oh, they're going to work it out. Like, if he just talks to her meanly, then that's not so bad. I have so many blogs. I wrote these blogs, and I was so miserable, and I didn't hide it. And I talked about marriage issues, and nobody called me and said, hey, so are you guys getting help for your marriage issues? Well, have you resolved them? How are you guys doing? Are you feeling better? You got a lot of kids. It's a lot. That's big pressure on a marriage. What's going on? And he doesn't have a job again. How's that working out for you? And it's like, so did I or didn't I reach out? Maybe I did. Maybe I did. I just didn't maybe say, I'm going to leave his ass. Help.
There's that whole saving face idea that happens when, so like, let's say you're super mad at me and we're fighting in the car, and then all of a sudden we pull up next to, oh, there's so-and-so from work. And then all of a sudden we're happy. Oh, hey, right? Like, our attitude and our image that we have about ourselves and the way we carry ourselves changes immediately when we're around other people.
Right.
So just the idea of calling someone that you're close to, whether it's a, you know, family member, a parent, a church friend, or whatever, that seems less scary than calling the police, but will achieve, I feel like, a very similar effect of that person who is freaking out, whether it's the wife or the husband, will go, I have to save face right now. I'm going to chill the crap out.
Yeah, and that's the theme of this whole podcast, is the fact that humans interact differently in the presence of other people or in relationship. There's an actual dynamic that goes on when things are open or brought out into the light that has actual effect on the facts themselves. So I think that's just a thematic thing in general, is to process things in the presence of or with other people, or attached to a narrative, or recognize people, or communicate directly. It's all the way down to, I notice when I listen to music, with different people, I hear different things. Mm-hmm. Just in imagining how they must be hearing something, mm-hmm. I now hear it differently. Mm-hmm. And so processing, I think humans are built that way to process things with other people.
Yeah.
I didn't have any contact with my mother for 15 years.
Here's Leslie Vernick again, continuing the story of her abusive childhood and what it looked like after 15 years apart from her mother.
She didn't really seek a relationship with me. I didn't seek one with her. But what I did do during those 15 years is I did my work. So I did the work that I needed to do to let go of my expectations for a mother, a grandmother. I let go of my anger and my hurt and my bitterness and all of that, so that when she got sick later in her life and she reached out to me and my brother and sister for some help, we were able to give it to her without resentment. I think for a long time, people of faith have gotten this idea that no matter what it takes, somehow I have to maintain the relationship at all costs, at any price. And I don't think that's true. I don't think that's possible. Even Jesus didn't maintain relationship with everybody. He couldn't. And he didn't have a relationship with everybody. He loved them, but he didn't have close relationship with the Pharisees. He didn't have close relationship with different people. And so I think we put this burden on ourselves or put on other people of expectations, like somehow you have to carry this burden of relationship when someone's cruel or deceitful or unfaithful or whatever it is, repeatedly and unrepentant. Jesus says it really clearly in Matthew 18, when you talk to someone and you tell them what they've done that has hurt you and they refuse to listen, refuse to listen, refuse to listen, the relationship is broken. He says, treat them as you would a pagan and a tax collector. You don't have the same kind of relationship. But I think we do confuse this concept of unconditional love, like we're supposed to love everybody, and we are, even our enemies. But God doesn't call us to unconditional relationship with everybody. And so even he doesn't have unconditional relationship with people. And so I think that's been really helpful to clarify that, because we can love our enemy. We don't have to have a relationship with them. We can love a spouse that's been abusive and care for them in terms of what is in their best interest. That's what love does. And it might be in their best interest to call the police when they're being abusive,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But they're not going to feel that. They're going to feel like, oh my gosh, you don't love me and we don't have a relationship, but I need to hold you accountable and have boundaries around your behavior, because that's in your best interest as well as mine.
And that's why you don't tell anybody. That's why you don't talk about some of the stuff, because you want to respect them, and you're taught to respect them, and you're expected to respect them. And out of respect, you keep your mouth shut. That's what we're taught. That's what I was taught. Because anytime I went to someone and said, hey, I don't, this is not the way it's supposed to be, they just patted me on the head and said, forgive. Or if I said it louder, then I'm the one who's disrespectful. And so it was easier to just not tell anybody.
I remember specifically every single morning, like for a split second, just a split second, I would wake up, realize that I was awake, realize that I was alive and conscious, and then it would hit me, it would wash over me like a black, just a wave of black water, like the reality of everything. I would wake up, have happiness, or not even happiness, just a moment, 2 seconds after waking up, be okay, and then remembering I'm married and this is my life, you know, and this is what we're going through right now. And then I would just almost go numb inside, having to face another day. And I think I felt like that for about a year and a half, literally.
I think that there is something to say, and I don't know how to explain this, because I don't think either one of you have domestically abused anyone mm-hmm. that I'm aware of. So it's a weird thing to communicate outwardly, because it might sound not true. But like, there was a moment when, after we had gone through everything, I had punched him in the face, I had clawed him, and we had fought, I had broken things, where I was like, what the hell am I doing? What am I doing? Why have I been doing this? And there was this moment of like clarity and understanding. It was not like this begging on my knees, oh, Seth, I'm so sorry, I'll never do this again. I did never declared any of those things to Seth.
Uh-huh.
They all seemed very trite to me to say, oh, I didn't know what I was doing. I stood up and went, I knew what I was like.
Mm-hmm.
I did those things.
So that explanation kind of sounds like a person with other addictive behaviors, you know, like you hear stories all the time in like chemical dependency. I was driving home one night for the fifth time in a row, drunk, not knowing where I was going, and crashed my car. And then after that, I said, what am I doing? What's going mm-hmm. on? And then that kind of like nodal event to where like, okay, boom, you put your stake in the ground. Mm-hmm. This is it, right? So it sounds like you after the abusive episodes, you really just kind of looked inside and said, what is this? This isn't me. Well, what's going on?
Essentially, it was like this massive feeling of deep ownership. Mm. Not necessarily, I mean, of course I feel bad and I'm sorry that I did it, but that is not the primary function of why I'm owning that I did it.
Right.
Because I think once, and then not just owning it, but saying, I have done this and telling other people. So there is something huge and immensely embarrassing. Even in this, the course of making this podcast, I have never wanted to talk about the time that I punched you. Right. I knew it was going to be a thing we would talk about, but every time we would get sort of near it, I would be like, please don't bring it up. Please don't bring it up. Mm-hmm. Knowing that that's what 90% of this show is about.
Yeah.
I have been so embarrassed to like, say out loud that I've done this, confess what it felt like, tell people what it looked like, what was happening, how stupid it was, where, like, what was the moment leading up to it? How did, you know, all of those things I've had this immense embarrassment about. Mm-hmm. And I think looking at it sort of from a different space, I feel like sharing that I was violent towards you is almost like an accountability. There's like a thing here that now people know
mm-hmm.
and people can say, okay, if you do that again, it's not okay.
Right. So therein lies the major difference between our DV situation and other DV perpetrators who continually fall into that cycle, mm-hmm. right? Like a key word here is I took deep ownership.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. Like, yeah. that's it. You didn't blame others.
Yeah. For I didn't your blame actions. You for me hitting you.
Right. You didn't justify your actions. You didn't say anything like that, what we typically hear in like regular DV situations. So that is the key. Mm-hmm. Like, I took deep ownership.
What do I wish someone had said to me? The book that probably saved me, if that's the right word, is called The Emotionally Destructive Marriage, and it wasn't even published till 2013. So could you have said that to me before? No. Like I said, I think there's an ignorance, flat out ignorance, about what abuse and emotional abuse looks like, and that the church needs to know when they're in over their head and when to refer out. The church needs to know, like, to have a litmus test because they don't do what. What do I wish? I wish someone had looked at me and said, he's treating you like garbage. Does he always treat you like that? What's it really like? And like, pick my brain and say, and then look at me honestly and say, don't tell me what I want to hear. Don't tell me what you think is popular. Because I found when I did tell people that it wasn't safe. It wasn't safe to tell them how bad it was, because they would just like, they would even like, you can't talk about your husband like that. I'm asking for help. Yes, I can. Yes, I can. And to know, and to reassure young wives, young moms, that you're not being disrespectful when you say, this doesn't feel right. And to stop encouraging women to just forgive. I mean, there's so many things I would say. I would start with those.
And I remember just being on my, like, on my face and on my knees for like 30 or 45 minutes straight, just crying and just praying. It was beautiful. In the sense of like, I can't do it. It was beautiful because I didn't have to do it. First of all, I couldn't do it by myself. And second of all, realizing that I couldn't do it and I didn't have to do it was the beautiful thing, I guess. And I remember feeling better after I'd, you know, been crying and just been on my face for so long. I was like, okay, you know, it's going to be okay. I don't know what it's going to be, but it will be okay. It's going to get better than it is. So that was a real time of kind of turnaround for me, emotionally, spiritually, maybe not physically. I was still physically tired, just tired of fighting, tired of thinking about it. And I remember, I think, waking up that morning, and I think that we actually took you, and I just gave you a big long hug and maybe prayed for you, for us, and just prayed out loud. There's definitely never been another time in my life where I've prayed as consistently or prayed as much than, you know, those handfuls of months.
And I do want to clarify and say and make sure people know, like, if you're being abused in any way, that's not all right. Like, it's not okay. Don't wait it out.
Get out immediately.
Yes, yes.
For sure. I mean, even the day that she hit you, wouldn't have been bad for you to get out. There would never really be anything wrong with anybody leaving at least the day or week that there was an incident. That's got to almost always be the right thing.
I think especially if there's children.
Right, but we have to also, sometimes it's not safe to leave. It can be even more dangerous to leave because in certain perpetrator situations, the person who is doing the DV may feel more threatened. And then things...
Like they said, if you leave, I'm going to kill you or kill myself or whatever.
Things escalate from there, right.
Actually, literally can't physically leave at that time. But if possible in any way to get out when there's an event is acceptable.
Get out or get help. Like call 911, text somebody. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're on your computer, pretend you're looking up something and text someone or email someone. Like, just connect,
There's no incident, even if it's a one-off incident where you go, okay, well, this is something we're going to have to work out in the future. It's a bigger deal than that, always.
Oh, it's a way bigger deal, yeah.
It's like my spirit was saying, run. Mm. And I think we stop listening to our spirits. Because, like, society says you get married, you stay married. Church says you get married, you stay married. And you stop listening to your heart. And I mean, I'm not like, you have to be careful how you say that. Because, like, you know, well, if I was doing what my heart tells me to do, I would look at Pinterest all day and eat chocolate all day. All day. I would never even do the Pinterest. I would just look at it and say, wouldn't it be nice? So not follow your heart like that, but, like, to question, like, to stop checking your brain at the door and to actually look at things critically and discern what's healthy, what's not healthy.
Domestic violence is such a complex and confusing thing, and I never in a million years could have imagined that I would be the perpetrator of so many ugly and violent moments in my marriage. And the idea that this reveals to me is that we need to be teaching people that they are really capable of anything, both beautiful things and terrible things. I wish that I had learned some sort of safe word that I could have shared with a friend or even my mother for moments where I felt flooded or overwhelmed and just needed help. But as a culture, we let our discomfort or fear smother our logic, and we just pretend or hope that domestic violence won't happen. But then we neglect to put in fail-safes and to educate people so that they know what to do if they find themselves in a domestic violence situation. If you're listening right now, it isn't really a bad idea to text your friend and say, hey, I need you to be my backup in case something goes wrong. Can I count on you to just let me tell you if I'm in trouble? There are a lot of ways to get help if you're in a domestic violence situation. And I'm not going to pretend that all of these situations are the same, but here's a quick list of places you can reach out if you need help. The first one on the list is Crisis Text Line. All you need to do is send a text to 741-741 and share that you need help. And what I think is so amazing about this text line is you can share if you're being hurt or if you think you might hurt someone else. And help is available around the clock. They answer 90% of texters within 5 minutes or less. And that type of help can literally save a life, and it's free. There's also the National Domestic Violence Hotline, where you can call or text 24/7 at 1-800-787-3224. There's also this movement to educate hairstylists to recognize the signs of abuse and assault and to provide customers with a list of helpful resources. And don't forget doctor's offices, WIC offices, places like that. Just know that there are people out there who love you even though they don't know who you are and they want to help you out. So please reach out if you're being hurt or you're afraid that you will hurt others. Our show is produced by me, Melanie Studley, along with co-producer Matt Carter, executive producer Craig Gross, and of course, everyone's favorite husband and co-host, Seth Studley. If you are enjoying the miniseries, we highly encourage you to subscribe to Anatomy of Marriage on iTunes and see what we're up to now. Season one of the miniseries is coming to an end, but over at Anatomy of Marriage, we still have lots of work to do and lots of new episodes for you to enjoy. We have Q&A sessions where Seth and I share listener questions and therapeutic resources, and season two comes out in less than 2 weeks and is going to be all about the tools of marriage, and y'all are not going to want to miss that. So come and find us at Anatomy of Marriage and continue on our messy journey. And as always, Jeff and Alyssa will be back next week. All right, see you later.